Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Think back to kindergarten. If you're over 30, your memories may be like mine. A lot of blocks and toys and finger paint, stories read aloud, maybe the odd counting or alphabet awareness activity. I also remember a lot of negotiating over who got to climb up in the little loft we had, only two at a time, and a fair amount of time just spent wandering from one busy group of kids to the next. And of course, we broke up that half day with a nap. If you compare what you did with what very young kids do today, skills drills and worksheets and fine motor skills activities, it looks like past generations wasted a lot of time just playing. But it turns out that for preschoolers, play is anything but a waste of time. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. As it happens, young children are designed by nature to build incredibly important skills just by exploring their worlds, which is hard to do in some modern early childhood classrooms. Erica Christakis is an early childhood educator at Yale University's Child Study Center. Her book is called The Importance of Being Little, What Preschoolers Really Need from Grownups, and she joins us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Erica, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
Setting aside the fact that many parents these days need childcare of some kind in order to work, what is the purpose of enrolling children in formalized school settings before first grade?
Well, I do think the childcare issue is a huge one. Right now in the United States, we have almost 75% of four-year-olds in some form of non-family care. So we really can't overlook the importance of just having a place to house children. Now, the reason to focus on early education, in my view, is to give children the foundation that they need in later life to function as healthy, happy, engaged human beings. And that kind of foundation doesn't come necessarily from a scripted, or rather, I would argue that it does not come from a sort of scripted curriculum with alphabet of the week tasks and what we call calendar work, where kids sit in a circle and have to sort of parrot back, you know, today is Monday, February 29th, which doesn't really have a lot of meaning to a four-year-old. The kind of skills we really want children to acquire have to do with emotional regulation, with social skills, and with a deep foundation in oral language, in talking and listening and having conversations. And those are the skills that are really linked not only to healthy outcomes emotionally later in life, but also to good, strong academic outcomes in later life as well.
We hear this phrase kindergarten readiness a lot these days, which I'm sure I'm understating it, but at one time was like the bare minimum of being potty trained and being able to cope with separation from the parents for a few hours every day. At this point, we really expect children to hit the ground running academically in kindergarten or even before.
That's right. But it's also important to understand that in some ways we have a bit of a mismatch problem. Mm. It's true that we are overtaxing children in lots of ways with these so-called readiness skills, which tend to have to do with identifying letters and shapes and colors and things like that. And we often overtax children in terms of the schedule. We have very rapid transitions that we subject children to. We have very little outdoor time. It's quite exhausting in a sort of practical way to be a preschooler or a kindergartner. But, you know, we also have a mismatch problem where we underestimate children. And I think that part of the argument about early education has been lost. The reality is that a lot of what goes on in preschools and kindergartens is intellectually boring and tedious and frustrating. And the kinds of learning that go on when kids are playing outdoors, when they're investigating, when they're watching, you know, let's say they're digging in the mud and collecting worms, observing animals, observing nature, playing, let's say, you know, the old-fashioned building forts or castles out of blocks. Those experiences actually are full of very important learning skills. We know that children who play with blocks use higher level language structures at play than they do if they're sitting at a table filling out a worksheet. You know, those worksheets that have like little cartoon grocery carts and then you have to match them to the number of items on the other side of the page. The kind of conversation you hear when kids are at a table doing that sort of activity is at a much lower level than what we see when kids are really deeply engaged in activities that are meaningful to them. So I do think we need to be careful. It's true that kids are being really overworked, but I like to say that kids are working more and learning less.
And yet when you see a teacher at the front of the room and the kids, you know, sitting around tables watching, that looks like school to us because that's what you might expect in first grade or third grade or fifth grade. And so somehow we feel like that direct instruction is what it's called, is more advanced than letting them engage in free play.
That's right. And if you walk into a preschool classroom or a kindergarten, you know, there are all kinds of cues visually that we adults respond to. So right now when you walk into these classrooms, the current sort of aesthetic is that there's lots and lots of writing on the walls. You see posters and checklists and all kinds of, they call them word walls and lists and all kinds of things that to an adult eyes we think, oh, that's learning. I earlier mentioned the calendar. There are probably, I would say, 98% of preschools in America do calendar work every day where kids sit in a circle and have to find the day of the week. They look at the calendar on the wall, and they go through this kind of repetitive and, frankly, very tedious activity. Now, one study showed that after a whole year of calendar work, half the children still didn't know what day they were on. So we have this activity that is both too hard and also too easy. It's boring and it's difficult. And so many of the things that we respond to as adults that seem to us to connote learning fall into this category of mismatch, where we're underestimating children's intellectual and emotional capacities, but we're sort of overestimating them in terms of, you know, their ability to this doesn't apply to a climate in Texas, but, you know, in the wintertime, a lot of children in cold climates spend a huge amount of time just putting on their winter clothes to get outside. And that transition is really difficult. And so they miss a lot of opportunities for play because the schedule is not child-sized. It's not scaled to what a child can do.
You write here about the extraordinary influence of the Perry Preschool, which seemed to demonstrate that high-quality preschool could literally have positive effects that lasted decades. What are the caveats that come with that conclusion and trying to really scale it to preschool classrooms around the country?
So that's a famous study from the 1960s. And the children in that program came from low-income environments, and they had certain identifiable risks. And they were given about 2 to 3 hours per day of what we call high-quality preschool education. So it really wasn't a heavy dose, but it was teachers who really understood child development and understood how to interact with children in a playful, inquiry-based, exploratory way. So these kids had a lot of playtime that was really rich and meaningful to them. And we found decades later that those children have a lot of positive outcomes, including things like, you know, lower teenage pregnancy rates, lower incarceration rates, higher incomes. So we know that quality matters. And what we know from decades of research is that there are two key factors that really influence preschool quality. One is, does the teacher understand child development? In other words, do you know what a typical four-year-old is able to do? The other factor that's really important is having a warm and responsive teaching style. In other words, do you know the individual child well? And it sounds like it would be something hard to measure, but it's actually not. There are a number of really good measures of preschool quality. Now, unfortunately, in terms of taking that to scale, it's easier to focus on factors that have less influence. For example, class size or the educational background of a teacher or the ratio of children to teachers. Those factors have, believe it or not, minimal impact on quality, but they're easier to regulate. And because preschool teachers are poorly paid and often have very little support to develop professionally, it's really hard to scale up, as you said, the models like the Perry Preschool Program, which require a lot of human capital. And, you know, as a former preschool teacher myself and as a former preschool director, as well as a parent, you know, it's very hard to work in a vacuum. You need to have support from colleagues. You need to have a chance to reflect on your teaching. And you need a decent salary.
If one adult is ready to, you know, have a long-term relationship and a mortgage at 27 and another isn't ready to settle down until 35, we really don't blink these days. Why, though, are we so adamant that very young children have to progress in their development along a prescribed timeline that may only give them, you know, wiggle room of a month or two to sort of get on board?
Well, it is outrageous when you put it that way. And I think we do have some reflection to do as adults because there are a lot of inconsistencies in our approach, as you said. I think that some of this anxiety about outcomes and about pushing children comes from a place of good intention. Starting in the early 2000s, and probably even before that in the 1990s, there was increasing concern about so-called achievement gaps or ability gaps between children who were born with certain advantages, namely financial advantages or having two parents in the home, and kids who were disadvantaged. And we saw that these achievement gaps, they widened very, very quickly. And so there was, I think there were some good intentions behind the standards movement, which, of course, we're all familiar with No Child Left Behind and with the Common Core and some of these attempts to improve quality that have pushed down and in many ways very developmentally inappropriately have been foisted on preschoolers and kindergartners. So I think we have to look more honestly now. We have a lot of research coming out that's casting a lot of skepticism on these kind of quick fixes. Right now, there's a study that just came out of Tennessee a few months ago that really was a very concerning study showing that children who went through state-funded pre-K in Tennessee actually did worse by second, third, and fourth grade than the children who didn't. Now, the authors of the study hypothesize that these children were subjected to a rather tedious, unimaginative, unplayful experience. And by the time they got to first or second grade, they were really fed up doing some of these rote activities day after day, month after month. So we need to look really carefully. Our good intentions are not enough if we're just foisting methods that don't work and that frustrate children. And let me be clear, these kids are really frustrated. Right now we have a growing problem of preschool expulsion. People sort of laugh when I say that, but it's a real thing. One of my colleagues at Yale, Walter Gilliam, has studied this extensively, and children in preschool are many times more likely to be expelled than kids in the K through 12 program system. We also have very alarming reports of more and more children being medicated sort of off-label for attention problems in the toddler and preschool years. And then there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that parents are very frustrated by, anxious, cranky, overtired kids. So we have a lot of signals from children that what we're doing is harming them. And I think we need to start listening to how to solve this sort of mismatch problem, or I call it the Goldilocks problem. You know, we often aim curriculum at just the wrong level. You know, we need to look more carefully at children and how they play, how they learn. Another problem is that we have a false dichotomy between play and work. Hmm. You know, and in the adult world, it makes sense. We often think about those two states as being in opposition. But we know, those of us who understand child development know that for children, there really is no divide between play and work. And I think when we continue to see that through adult eyes, we really miss a chance to help kids get into that peak learning zone.
We're speaking this hour with Erica Christakis. She is an early childhood educator at Yale University's Child Study Center, and she's just published a book called The Importance of Being Little, What Preschoolers Really Need from Grownups. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email us at think@kera.org, or I'm on Twitter, and you can send me a message there at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Erica Christakis. She joins us from Yale University's Child Study Center to talk about her book, The Importance of Being Little, What Preschoolers Really Need from Grownups. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Erica, you write about a teacher using a technique called shared reading as she read a story aloud to her little students. And although she clearly wanted to do the right thing, it seems like the whole approach is like the fastest possible way to suck the joy out of story time.
Yes, that's right. This was a teacher who, in a sort of misguided attempt to follow the standards and mandates that she was required to follow, was reading, one of the Eric Carle books, you know, Brown Bear, What Do You See? And she would read out the word question mark. So it was actually, polar bear, what do you hear? Question mark. I think she even put some commas in there, too. You know, this is sort of teaching to the test on steroids. It's really missing the forest for the trees. And I think we need to push back on this because we are losing the chance to give children a foundation in rich oral language that they get from play, from making friends, from being really engaged in things that interest them. A lot of what we see in preschools and kindergartens is not terribly interesting or engaging to children. And so then we have to resort to a lot of sort of disciplinary measures to kind of keep them in line because they appear restless or bored. For example, probably every American adult has made one of those iconic Thanksgiving turkey hand tracings where you outline your hand, the left hand, at Thanksgiving, and then you add little googly eyes and feathers. These kinds of activities to adults appear cute and fun, but often have very little meaning to a young child. And so we have to sort of cajole them and hound them to come over and do their projects. And, you know, parents really like these kinds of things because, as a parent myself, I can attest to this. You know, we like to put things on the refrigerator wall. We like to have things that our children make. But a lot of the curriculum in preschools and kindergartens is sort of organized around this idea of making things rather than making meaning. Hmm. And so I think we have to be really careful when we give children activities or when we read to them, when we read them a story, are we focusing on these outcomes that look cute or interesting to an adult, or are we really fostering interesting, engaging learning in young kids? And I think those are two different issues. I had a conversation with a little kid just a couple of weeks ago in Pittsburgh, and he was very, very interested in planets and stars. And he was talking to me about black holes. And he turned to me with the most incredible earnestness, and he said, "You know what? I think God might have made the black holes." And then he didn't miss a beat, and he turned to his little friend and he said, "And that's the big mystery about God." And I thought, you know, this is the kind of thing that kids talk about all the time. Mm-hmm. They talk about death. They talk about spirituality. They get angry. They have intense emotions. There's a lot we can tap into. There's a lot we can leverage in children's learning. They are really smart, powerful people. And instead, we design curriculum around things like tracing their hand to make a totally phony-looking Thanksgiving turkey that people have been doing for decades and decades. Or we read stories where we say, polar bear, what do you hear? Question mark. I mean, this is devoid of, you know, it sounds like a parody. And the thing is, I don't want to critique the teachers because they are trapped. You know, they are really stuck in a system which is measuring not only the children's outcomes, but the teachers' abilities. They are stuck in a system that has really chopped up learning standards. So if you go back to kids building a castle with blocks, you know, they're doing all kinds of learning and they're acquiring lots of skills. They're doing everything from geometry and measurement and physics to, as I said, you know, they're using higher level vocabulary words. You know, kids who are really engaged in something often use extremely specific sort of complex vocabulary. If you've ever had a three-year-old who's obsessed with vehicles, you know, you learn all these words that you might not know. I've sort of lost track of my vehicle names, but, you know, excavators and backhoes, and kids who are interested in something really use high-level vocabulary. So children are using all of these skills. But if you're a teacher trying to meet standards, oftentimes it's much easier to teach, let's say, the letter of the week than it is to say, okay, this castle building activity is covering all kinds of learning objectives. But how do you sort of parse them and chop them up and check them off on a checklist? It's more demanding. And I have great sympathy for teachers who feel really stuck with this more scripted and sort of tedious and frustrating curriculum, because they don't get a lot of support for this whole holistic kind of learning that we all know is there.
Do you happen to have a copy of the book in front of you?
You know, I do not, and that's just a terrible oversight.
No, it's okay.
But I know the book well.
Well, you have a little bit of fun in the book imagining physical intimacy between adult partners as it would be decontextualized and taught under something like Common Core standards, or any – we don't use Common Core in Texas, but basically the kind of curriculum standards that exist across the country.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm sorry I didn't bring my book with me. I really should have. But, you know, what I try to do is get – and I try to do this throughout the book – is to really get adults to see the world through children's eyes. So I take these standards. You know, there'll be things like understands place value or understands, you know, numbers from 11 to 20. And, you know, my argument is that when you're four, you might learn the letter B on one day and notice that it resembles a lowercase d. But if you're only learning B 1 week and you're learning D 3 weeks later, you know, the learning isn't integrated. It's not leveraging the kind of broad, expansive thinking that children are capable of. So what I did was I tried to take adults through the process of imagining buying a book on improving your, to be blunt, your sex life or your intimate life. And I tried to chop it up into these standards. And I sort of had some fun with, you know, well, it's a little hard to paraphrase, but the kind of standards where you would be going through very scripted conversation with a partner, or, you know, carefully removing your socks and counting how many toes you had on your feet. These kinds of things that people don't do when they're having a normal adult interaction with someone. But when we teach children, we cut up these standards, we chop them up, we take them out of context, and it's very tedious and rather silly at times.
We all want our children to be safe and well cared for at school, which is part of the thinking behind zero tolerance policies for violence, for sexual harassment. But your concern is that these have been taken to ridiculous extremes. What would be more effective?
Well, I think we have this problem that I call adultification, where we really look at kids through adult eyes. And so, you know, you might have a little child who kisses another child. Often kids have very strong feelings. They actually feel very passionately for their little friends. And, you know, we view this through the lens, through the adult lens of, let's say, sexual harassment. I do find it ironic that children who use pretend guns can be suspended from school. And yet adults who use real guns, you know, we don't have any concern about that. And to me, that's a bit of an irony, you know, that we often really apply these kind of adult perspectives on how children think and how they interact with others. I think a more appropriate approach is to really observe children and try to understand where they're coming from. Where is their frustration or anger coming from? Are there ways that we can make early education, if we can make classrooms less frustrating for them? You know, a lot of times kids act out because the schedule just doesn't allow them time for transitions. Or, as I said, they're bored and irritated by some of the curriculum that we foist on them. You know, people often say that children have extremely short attention spans. But if you've ever watched a kid, let's say in the bathtub, you know, who turns blue and you have to sort of drag him out of the tub or out of a swimming pool, you know that kids actually have very long attention spans when they're really engaged in something. Similarly, kids who are often seen as being reckless and out of control and unable to keep their hands to themselves, you know, you watch them when they're holding a baby animal or a new baby sibling, you know, with extraordinary care and tenderness. And yet we tend to view little children as out of control and unable to regulate themselves. So I think it's really the responsibility of the adults to try to understand why children have so many struggles in school, you know. And we have to remember that schooling and learning are two different things at times. And a lot of times school environments really are not pro-learning environments. And that's where we often see children struggling and acting out.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. I will note before my question that this has been so liberating. I have these four things my children made in elementary school for Mother's Day, teacups and teapots, and I never threw them out. I felt like just the worst mother in the world if I didn't keep these artifacts of their childhood. But these are the least inventive in things that they brought home. This is from the school. They're exactly the same thing for both kids. So thank you. I'll throw them out.
Yes, you should be liberated.
Oh, I've got a lot more. I'll go look in the file. I stayed home with the kids. And by the time they got to school, they were readers. It wasn't something I intentionally sat and said, this is A, B, C. They picked it up in the context of being read to in Sesame Street. So the discussion begs the question, and it may be in your book, do you compare not only these preschool children in general amongst themselves, but do you compare children who, say, were in daycare from infancy to children who were at home with a parent?
Well, my belief is, as I said, that learning and schooling are two different things. I'm not at all prepared to say that one environment is better than the other, because I think we just don't have any evidence that that's the case. The most important learning environment for a child is really between is in the relationships that the child has between the parent and the child and, of course, other loved ones. So I think that I wouldn't want to be in the position of sort of comparing and contrasting and saying that one is better than the other. But I am prepared to say that we have to look really carefully when we look at preschool outcomes and we talk about what children need. You know, we really need to understand what do we mean by quality. And I think most developmental experts in early childhood would say that when those relationships are strong, children can learn and thrive in a whole variety of environments. And when those relationships are not strong, they really can't. And so sometimes these classroom settings that look, you know, that give the sort of superficial appearance of being learning environments can actually be kind of stultifying. And in contrast, children who are at home with their families, and of course, not everyone can afford this, you know, sometimes those environments, which may not appear to be so educational, can actually be extremely stimulating and enriching for children. So I think, you know, we just have to look at what does it mean to be a learner, to be a young child. It means to be in relationship. It means to be able to play and to be engaged. And I think we can find that in all kinds of settings.
I remember a lot of kindergarten interaction and stuff on the playground, even in later years. Frankly, a lot of arguing with other kids, a lot of, you know, figuring out what it meant to play a game, to follow the rules, to have somebody, you know, sort of come down on the side of one player or another. Now it seems like a lot of schools try to bypass this, and there's a curriculum, right, that's designed to explain friendship and character and how you follow rules and turn-taking and how you apologize. Do we know how one functions versus the other?
Well, that's a great question. There's a whole sort of almost industry of these social and emotional curriculum. And on the one hand, I have to say as an educator that I'm really glad that we're starting to pay attention to children's social and emotional lives. But on the other hand, as you said, there's a kind of scripted quality, and it's really sort of managed, stage managed, if you will, by adults. And so I think it's really an open question. Do these, you know, oftentimes these programs will have sort of 30 minutes per week, or maybe a few minutes per day, where there's a particular question or a challenge, and it's often linked to a book with a very specific sort of moral lesson. And on the one hand, you know, it's not a bad way to do things, but I have to ask, there are some really time-tested ways that children acquire emotional and social competence, and they do it through the kinds of things you describe. One of the best ways for kids to develop these skills is through mixed-age play, you know, which is sort of the ultimate teacher. You know, to be both a younger and an older child in that kind of a scenario is very enriching. And I worry that we're taking so much away from kids in terms of natural settings for play. And then we sort of, you know, try to compensate by having these formal curriculum that schools purchase and get training in. And I am a little bit skeptical sometimes. I wonder, are we really getting the results we want? And if we had more faith in children and faith in child development, I think we could loosen the reins a bit and give kids the chance to work out these things on their own.
Since you mentioned mixed-age play, that leads nicely into Michael's email question, which is, what is your opinion of Montessori education?
Well, Montessori is one of a number of pedagogies that I think have been extremely meaningful and helpful for educators and for families worldwide. You know, Montessori definitely really kind of raised the bar in a major way in terms of really watching children intentionally, observing them, understanding how they think, respecting them as thinkers. You know, the original sort of Montessori method, as promoted by Maria Montessori, didn't have a lot to say about play. And I think the 21st century version of Montessori is beginning to embrace, or has embraced, a lot of the wonderful research that we have on play. And the reason that's important is because with more and more kids in institutional care, I said earlier in this show that about almost 75% of four-year-olds are in non-family care. And so in the old days, kids who didn't have a playful environment at school had time to play outside of school. But now that children are spending so many hours in institutional care, we really do need to pay a lot of attention to the social aspect of learning. But that said, I think Montessori had some wonderful contributions. And at the top of the list is this deep respect for children as learners, as thinkers.
And when you're assessing a teacher, and we're about to go to a break here, so I'm going to ask this question now and we'll come back to it. But I'd like you to think about the things that you're paying attention to in terms of what makes for an effective interaction between teacher and student, and why. I think the figure you gave was like 1 out of 4 interactions are effective and 3 out of 4 are not. And I want to talk a little bit about that when we come back.
It's even worse, actually.
Okay. All right. We'll get that, the correct number in just a minute. My guest is Erica Christakis. She joins us from Yale University's Child Study Center. Her new book is called The Importance of Being Little: What Preschoolers Really Need from Grownups. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Today, as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative, we're speaking with Yale University Child Study Center professional Erica Christakis. Her new book is called The Importance of Being Little: What Preschoolers Really Need from Grownups. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Erica, what is the ratio of effective to ineffective interactions between early childhood teachers and their students?
Well, believe it or not, one study that looked at 700 preschools around the country determined that only 15% of them featured what we would call effective communication between children and their teachers. That's really sobering, and we need to fix that. And there are some really major sort of structural impediments, one of which is salary, which we talked about. Preschool teachers are, especially the ones who aren't teaching in a public school system, increasingly some of them are, but the ones who work in sort of freestanding programs, you know, really don't have the professional support and salary to develop as strong teachers. It's a challenge. But I think there's something more fundamental, which is that we are looking, again, at these kind of, you know, we have this mismatch or this sort of Goldilocks problem where we're really missing where children learn. So one of the things that I look for when I go into a preschool, I look for, or rather I listen for, signs of active conversation. And I mean two-way conversation. So we hear a lot of very scripted speech in early childhood classrooms where the teacher is doing a lot of the talking, and it's kind of one-directional. So you might hear, you know, clean up, everybody, or you sort of sing-songy things. Teachers might say to a child who's drawing a picture, oh, that's a nice bunny rabbit you've drawn. Well, that's what we call a closed statement. It doesn't really invite the child in. For one thing, the child may not be drawing a rabbit. It may be something totally different. Or the child may not even have a clue what she's drawing. A simple change when a teacher says, tell me about your drawing, you know, that, believe it or not, is a really different statement. It's an open statement compared to, good job, I like your bunny rabbit. You know, so I listen for signs of open, two-way conversation, dialogue. I listen for laughter. I think that's really important. You know, even in programs where kids are doing really scripted activities, and let me just say there are a lot of teachers who know that this stuff is not ideal, but they are doing it for a variety of reasons. When kids really love their teachers and when the teachers really love the children, you can feel it. You can see it. And I always look for that. I look for evidence that teachers are getting on the floor with kids where they're actually at eye level. Another thing that I notice is the amount of stuff on the walls. Do I see the children themselves reflected? Do I see their learning processes made visible? And by that, I mean I'm less interested in looking at, 25 little egg carton caterpillars with identical googly eyes and pipe cleaners. To me, that is not telling me anything about the children, about their interests or capacities. If I saw photographs on the wall of children digging around in the dirt, actually looking for insects, to me, that would be a more reassuring sign that the teachers are valuing the children's experiences. But I do want to emphasize and I want to reassure people because many of us don't have choices with childcare. You know, it's expensive for many families. It's actually more expensive even than college tuition. So I want to reassure people that even if you don't feel that you have access to the kind of program that I'm talking about, the quality of relationship between the parent and child is just the most fruitful environment for learning that can exist. And that's true for anyone at any income level. It's not something that you have to be wealthy to avail yourself of. You know, having these open conversations with children, giving them open-ended things to play with, like blocks, rather than toys that have only one purpose. These are the kinds of things that all families can do at any income level and no matter what childcare choices you're making.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Doug on the line in Rockwall. Hello, Doug.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Hello, Erica. I've got a question for you. I need to set the table a little bit. There's an attorney friend of mine, and his wife has a terminal degree in sociology. These are really well-read people. Here's my question. When we have dinner gatherings there, they have a young 4.5-year-old girl and a 5.5-year-old boy. Paul goes into the classics while the kids are at the table. Now, they're dismissed early. They don't sit for the entire adult conversation. But he goes through Lord Macaulay, the history of England. He talks about Oswald Spengler and the decline of the West. The other night, we go there maybe once a month. The other night, we got into a talk about justice with respect to Plato and Socratic arguments. Now, he actually has them draw the name Spengler because they've never seen it before, and he doesn't do this to impress us. The children truly are engaged. Here's my question for you. When kids go back and forth and they speak about justice on a child's terms, and Paul's very careful about that, that justice here may be sharing a baseball mitt or, you know, who gets more time playing with what toy. But when they do that on their level and engage them, are there repercussions later on if these kids enter into classical training from their parents? Does it put them in an awkward position in terms of what the rest of their classmates are doing?
Well, thank you very much, Doug. I appreciate your call, and I think we've got the gist of it. What do you think about that, Erica?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think first of all, you know, every family has its own culture, and things that work with one family, you know, may not work for another family. It sounds like these kids, you know, have a really deep relationship with their parent, and so they're learning from their child. You know, I think Socrates was obviously onto something in terms of this dialogue, questioning approach, this kind of back and forth that you're describing. And there are different ways to do that. If your question is, you know, what happens to these kids later, I think we are I guess I'll answer that a little bit more generically rather than just specifically in this case. I think we have an opportunity with a generation of kids to give them more experience wrestling with ideas, learning how to be in dialogue, learning how to tolerate disagreements, to understand the point of view of other people. I think this is essential for all human beings. And I think it starts very early. And sometimes we really underestimate young children's capacity to be really deep thinkers.
You suggest that adults working in early childhood education settings refrain from using the word bully. How did that term become overused exactly at a time when documentable incidences of bullying have actually declined?
Well, I'm not sure where that comes from. I do think media attention to bullying, you know, has certainly made us aware of the concept. But in fact, bullying is on the decline for a number of reasons, which I won't really get into now. But I will say that oftentimes bullying happens in school environments when teachers are not really tuned into kids. It often happens in hallways or on school buses and things like that. So we've had a real success in terms of reducing episodes of bullying. But there is a tendency, as often happens, when you hear about something, you tend to sort of suddenly, you know, you start seeing it everywhere. And so we've kind of overused this word where it relates to young kids. And the reason that's important is that, again, it's this mismatch where we're not really understanding where little kids are developmentally. 4 and 5-year-olds really aren't capable of bullying per se. You know, that's a very chronic action. It's not just a one-off mean behavior. There's an intentionality to it that is really extremely rare. I won't say it never happens, but it's extraordinarily rare that 3 and 4 and 5-year-olds are actually bullying. And I think we have to be careful not to use labels that don't apply to young children, because if we are calling certain behaviors bullying, we may be really missing opportunities to help children work out problems on their own. We may be labeling kids in ways that are quite toxic, you know, where they, you know, we sort of assume that a child is a quote, bad kid. And I think that kind of stuff is really dangerous. And if we really look at how children think and how they are developmentally, then we can sort of get away from some of these damaging adult labels that keep kids from thriving.
There are two things, Erica, that I tried to teach my kids sooner than they were ready, or, you know, various ones among them were ready, and that was bicycle riding and toilet training. Had I waited until the moment that they were set to go, it would have taken, you know, a matter of minutes or hours, maybe. Could the same thing be true for reading? Is it possible that if we just waited and kind of relaxed a little bit about phonemic awareness and letters and all that until a particular moment in child development, that they would learn to read faster?
Well, you know, that's a complicated question, and I'll try to answer it in two ways. First of all, there is huge cultural variation in the age at which kids learn to read. And some countries that really have outstanding education systems don't teach formal reading until age 6 or 7. Of course, I'm thinking of the Scandinavian countries and some other countries. So there is, you know, there is no sort of magic moment biologically where kids need to learn to read. And of course, reading itself is a really recent skill if you look at sort of the history of humanity. Unlike learning to talk, you know, reading is really, it's only been around for a few thousand years. So there is a lot of evidence that, you know, this sort of magic age is really a culturally constructed thing. And in fact, we know 20 years ago, only something like 20 or 30% of surveyed kindergarten teachers thought kids needed to learn in kindergarten. Now it's 80%. So, you know, the child's brain has not changed in that period of time, but our expectations have changed. Now, that said, one of the really important foundations of literacy is oral language, talking and listening. What you called phonemic awareness, which is being able to understand and to hear the difference you know, between bat and cat, you know, to hear that there's a b sound and a k sound in those two words and that they're different. That actually is really an important skill. But that doesn't mean you have to teach it in this formal way where the teacher is pointing to the words in a very kind of pedantic way. I mean, kids learn it through singing, through rhyming, through nursery rhymes, through play, through sort of playfully making up nonsense words with their names. That's how kids have learned that sort of sound awareness for centuries. So I would argue that we need to give kids much, much more, a much deeper and broader foundation in oral language, conversation, and ease up on the sort of decoding skills, which would be the letter-sound connection. And I think we do that, you know, happily, we do that through giving them more time to play and develop friendships. So it's kind of a win-win because they're developing more social and emotional regulation, and the research shows they're actually gaining the foundation in literacy that we need. What it requires of adults is that we adopt a longer perspective. You know, right now we're focusing on these short-term objectives like letter awareness that we can check off on our standards checklist, but longer term, those kids aren't developing the real foundation they need for learning. And that's where I said kids are working more but learning less. So we need to adopt the long-term strategy, the long-term focus, and not get so hung up on, you know, these measures like being able to, you know, recognize shapes and colors and letters and so on. Those skills are all important, but those can come and they will come. And we need to really focus on the bigger picture, which is conversation and engagement, being intellectually and emotionally engaged in what kids are interested in doing.
Rather than a lot of really pedantic testing, you say what young children need are challenges. Can you talk about the kinds of challenges that can, you know, spark kids to make gains in learning and also assess the progress that they've made?
Well, a lot of educational theorists talk about this sort of peak learning zone, which is just that just right spot where kids are learning. They're being challenged, but it's not so challenging that they give up in frustration. But it's sort of right where they need to be. And I think that learning zone requires us to have more faith in kids. We need to let them get right up to the edge of something that might be frustrating or scary. I think it means we need to give them more physical challenges because when you're 3 and 4, you learn through physical engagement with the world. You know, we need to get kids outdoors more. We need to let kids have disagreements or make each other angry and figure out how to get back to a place of comfort. So the challenge is really to loosen the reins and to have faith that children are capable of learning. And I think it's much easier as an educator to say, okay, well, I'm going to teach the letter A this week and the letter B next week, and we're going to do triangles this week, and we're going to do, you know, the color purple next month. That is a fear-based pedagogy. You know, that is really underestimating what kids can do. And we need to get away from that fear so we can open up the world of childhood. We can let kids really take risks. And sometimes it's a little bit scary. And we live in a culture where we've sort of we've become less and less familiar with what are age-appropriate risks for children, learning risks. And I think we need to kind of reacquaint ourselves with what a 4-year-old or 5-year-old is really capable of.
Erica Christakis is an early childhood educator at Yale University's Child Study Center. Her new book is called The Importance of Being Little, What Preschoolers Really Need from Grown-Ups. She joined us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Erica, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.